Okay, one last speaker, and then we'll have a few minutes, I think, for questions and answers. The one thing that I've noticed, it's come up again all day yesterday and again today, that there is a need for leadership and there is a need for what some people are referring to as champions. Well, that's, I think, part of what David Bell is going to be talking about. He's a professor emeritus and a senior scholar and former dean of the Faculty of Environmental Studies at York University in Toronto, and he'll be talking about training a new breed of leader for sustainability. So please welcome David Bell.
Thanks so much, Peter. These conferences are wonderful. This is one of the greatest conferences I've attended. And of course, when you go to conferences, you meet people. Sometimes you meet people you've never met before. And I've had the pleasure of meeting someone who took his PhD degree at exactly the same ceremony at Harvard University that I attended 40 years ago. It's terrible to admit that, Howard Moscovich. He said that when he received the degree, his supervisor said to him, "Now remember, Howard, don't let your training interfere with your education." And that reminded me of my favorite Wizard of Id cartoon. Some of you may know the Wizard of Id. In this case, the wizard is interviewing candidates for the position of stable hand. And he's got this one candidate. He says, "Do you have any education?" He says, "Well, I have a PhD in political science." He says, "I take it that's a no." So I mentioned this because I wanted you to be aware, if you haven't already noticed, that the title I'm showing up here is not the same title that appeared in the program, which talked about training a new breed of leader for sustainability. I think that was something chosen by the conference organizers, and like Jürgen, I've had a bit of a problem with that title. So I've changed it, and not only are we talking about education rather than training, nowhere am I talking about breeding. If there is a genetic element in producing the leadership we need, it involves cultural DNA, as I'll try and argue, rather than any kind of eugenics. I wanted to just acknowledge with all of you that over the last two, or actually three, and I guess if you count the Grameen workshop, 4 days, we've had a really quite striking and I think quite refreshing look at a number of challenges. And particularly I enjoyed Daniel's presentation because I had seen it earlier in our workshop, and I think it outlines many of those challenges. The kind of question I'm looking at here is, what kind of leadership do we require, does humanity require, if we are going to successfully respond to those challenges? And what does education have to do with developing that kind of leadership? I wanted to begin with some of the quotations we've heard around this subject, because we've heard a lot of people say things throughout the conference that I think relate very directly to my theme. So we've had people indicate that we need to change mindsets, we need a new paradigm, we need to rethink, we need to reinvent. We heard John McCarthy yesterday say, "I didn't know about this growing up in Vancouver." People talking about we need to change the conversation, we need to change the culture. So we've heard a lot of things, all of which I think are redolent with implications for education. At the same time, we've heard a sort of counter strain, talking about education as a waste of time, by which I think people were referring to providing more information or making more pamphlets. So I want to clear up the conundrum that creates. It's both, I think, a paradox, and it's a particularly ironic paradox, given that we are meeting here at a conference sponsored by an institute of higher education, a very distinguished one. All of us have multiple degrees. We are all in some sense the products of years of formal education, and in some instances I think we would say we have arrived here because of our education, and yet and many of us are in the business of education. I use that phrase quite advisedly, because education itself is a major business, and we're talking about the link between business and health. So it's ironic that we have some of us denigrated education as not having a role in producing a sustainable future. I want to argue to the contrary, but I want to also suggest that our ideas about education and leadership are changing, and it's there are interesting parallels between the way they are changing as we move into the 21st century. In leadership, we are now talking about flattening the hierarchy, about moving more from power and authority to influence, about moving from command and control to visioning, engagement, and collaboration, from the leader as hero to the leader as enabler or supporter. And a similar transformation is taking place in our ideas about education. I just want to remind you, I'll come back to this at the end of my talk, that the word education actually has the word leadership embedded in its core. It is from the Latin educere, to lead out. But we have changed the emphasis in education from teaching to learning, from an idea of depositing information in the empty vessel that is the student, to a different approach. Freire talked about problem posing, action learning. There are a whole variety of ways which have shifted the emphasis from teacher to learner. So the teacher has a different role then. Instead of the expert providing all this information, the teacher becomes the coach, facilitator, and resource person. We no longer refer to pupils, and as I say, we don't even talk about students. There are some places, for example, Royal Roads University, where they speak only of learners. They don't refer to the people there as students. A little bit more on educating or learning, because there is not always a perfect correlation. Not all education results in learning. And we often learn things outside formal education. You can contemplate for a while the lessons we have learned from the global financial crisis, for example, some of which, of course, are being taught in classrooms now, but much of that learning took place outside of the classroom. There is a huge role of the internet, and you know, we had some books on display yesterday, and there are new books on display today from a different conference. Since this conference began yesterday morning, approximately 6,000 books have been published around the world. I mean, that's pretty staggering. And there have been over 60 billion Google searches performed in the last 2 days. The internet makes available to students and to learners of all kinds an incredible array of information and material that would be very hard to have assembled in one place over the course of a lifetime and in an instant. So we talk about social learning and social networking, and of course the importance of lifelong learning. All of that being said, there's still staggering amounts of ignorance, and I'll just share with you a statistic that takes my breath away. In one of the wealthiest, perhaps the wealthiest, and certainly the most powerful country in the world today, the United States, there are four times as many people who believe in strict creationism, that is, that the world is 5,000 years old and was produced pretty much the way you see it today. There are four times as many who believe in strict creationism as believe in evolution. So that's something to contemplate. I want to now give you a different take on the challenge of sustainability and what I'm calling the crisis of the 21st century. I believe the challenge of sustainability is the most important crisis of the 21st century. And there are many different formulations about sustainability. We've heard some of them through the conference. Actually, my two favorite definitions of sustainability, one is connecting the dots, and the other one is conversations about the future. But I want to relate the challenge to the topic of education. I think really what we are facing as a species is the need to learn to live differently on this planet so that current and future generations can have, well, we can put the good in brackets because the question could be asked, if you extend it into the future, any life at all. And again, from all the things that we've heard, we are clearly on a path that is unsustainable. It's not necessary for me to rehearse any of that. But I would like to just draw attention to two rather pithy quotations that I think are very germane. One from Al Gore, and the other from Kofi Annan, focusing on the need for a change in mindset or a change in attitudes, a change that will result in different behaviors, to be sure. We're not just talking about things that have to change in theory, but things that have to change in practice. And the question is, how can you achieve those kinds of changes? And here's a little bit of ancient Chinese wisdom that I think is very apropos. And it inspired me to take a 100-year lens and not only focus it into the future, but first focus it on the past. Looking back 100 years, just to contemplate some of the changes that have taken place in our world over those 100 years, the population less than a third of what it is today, the prevalence of empires, very few countries, few technologies, national business and finance, a minuscule civil society sector, very little concern about the kinds of global problems that we are now very much aware of. Not even an image of the Earth from space. The image that is quoted in the opening paragraph of the Brundtland Commission, Our Common Future, as something that may have transformed our understanding of the challenges we face. So what happens when you point the lens in the other direction, look ahead 100 years? What are the kinds of problems we are going to have to cope with? When it's very hard to predict the future, but certainly we can project some trends into the future. And we've, again, been hearing about these, the importance, and much of our focus has been how you could, in fact, meet those basic needs for a large population, how you could stabilize the climate, reduce poverty, achieve a factor 10 or much more likely a factor 20 economy. This refers to the throughput of energy and material resources, reducing it by at least a factor of 10, more likely a factor of 20. It's a different way of stating something that was pointed out on the opening night, that if we all lived at the current levels of consumption and waste production that are found in the wealthy countries, we'd need something like 3 or 4 additional planets Earth. And that is going to involve as well transforming the way industry operates, to mimic nature, biomimicry, cradle to cradle rather than take, make, waste. Really transform all of this, I think, can be captured under the notion of sustainable enterprise. We heard Stu Hart talk about this and others talk about it. How do we transform 20th century capitalism into 21st century sustainable enterprise? How do we achieve a society that is less violent and more peaceful? This is quite an agenda of challenges. And the question I'm asking is, what sort of education is needed to try and train leaders who can help us cope with those problems? Well, that is really what Education for Sustainable Development is aiming to achieve. And I think it is a necessary but perhaps not a sufficient condition for making those changes, but it should become general education for the 21st century. There shouldn't be anybody who isn't exposed to this. It will require reorientation of all professional and technical post-secondary education across all professions. Of course, much of this is already happening, including in places like the business school that is hosting this conference, along with the health faculty, where it's also going. But we can't stop there. Most of the leaders who are currently in positions where they have their hands on the wheel of history, to use Max Weber's phrase, didn't get this kind of education in any of the formal education they receive, so we need non-formal. That's executive development kinds of things, professional training, other kinds of training. And indeed, much of that is underway, and Stu Hart and I were involved in something called the Sustainable Enterprise Academy, which was started about 10 years ago to provide this to senior leaders in business and in government. In fact, governments may need this more than business. We also need to strengthen the informal ESD. Informal ESD is that which shapes public attitudes, public awareness around these issues. And we need a supportive public, both to support the businesses that are making this transition to sustainable enterprise, and to force governments to do it, and to participate in the NGOs and civil society activities. So it's really a societal project. As I mentioned, or perhaps I didn't mention, this is the UN decade for education for sustainable development. We're actually at the midpoint. And just to step back and look at some of the global challenges, it's easy to think of these things in a North American or wealthy country context. But when you look at it globally, we have huge challenges. Nearly a billion people are illiterate, most of them women. There's 75 million people who are denied access, children denied access, including people like the young girl that featured in one of Daniel's slides. The level of educational achievement in different parts of the world is quite dramatically different. We're used to a system where a lot of people go on to post-secondary. Parts of the world, most people don't finish elementary school, and in parts of Africa, they don't get a year's formal education. And that's why the UN has declared as one of the Millennium Development Goals, education for all. And when you're talking about changing formal education, another little sobering statistic, there's a mere 60 million teachers that need to be engaged in this. One of my colleagues has taken on the task of trying to organize that for UNESCO. I want to argue, I'm going to move quickly through these last few slides, that, as I say, ESD is education for the 21st century. That kind of education required is a transformation. It's not the kind of education we currently have, except in rare instances, but we're talking about transforming it along these lines, giving students the capacity to think in systems terms, relating education to action, taking students outside the classroom and into the community and bringing the community into the classroom, getting people to appreciate that we are part of nature and that we need to relate differently to the rest of nature, and inspiring concern for others, both present and future generations, strengthening the capacity to think creatively about the future. I'm going to move quickly on this. It's interesting that these ideas about leadership that I talked about earlier, I think really reinforce this notion that we're not looking for single heroes here. We're looking for a different type of leadership. And indeed, one of the great leadership international gurus right here in the faculty at McGill, Henry Mintzberg, has talked about the need to move from the cult of leadership to something he calls communityship, which really recognizes that we are all in this. And leadership does not need to come from the top of an organization or institution or society. It can come from anywhere. And that is very consonant with ideas about sustainability leadership that, again, show that we need to learn new ways to collaborate around this shared concern for the future. And I want to, I'll skip over this. There are, of course, ways of training leaders so that they have some of the capacity to develop that new kind of leadership. But I want to move to my conclusion, ask the question, can education lead us out of the present crisis? And argue that we require leadership, a new kind of leadership throughout society, that all aspects of education are implicated, and again, that we are part of the UN decade. Now, should we be optimists? Is this thing possible? I think one of the great virtues of this conference is not only, to paraphrase Mark Twain, are we talking about these issues, we're actually committed to doing something about them. But we must remember the Russian proverb that a pessimist is an informed optimist. Some of you will have been aware of the geography of hope idea, that the fact that environmentalists have spent way too much time talking about the threats and not enough time, not enough attention focused on opportunities. And I like very much Sir Michael's statement that he was an evidence-based optimist. What are the implications for us gathered here today? Well, I would encourage you to connect to the UN Decade activities in your own country or your organization to add your expertise. I mean, one of the things that we've discovered is a gap or a weakness is, in fact, creating the understanding of business and the economy and the opportunity for business to make a difference in a positive way in the world. Strengthen the conversations about that, especially in the K to 12. And, whoops, I'm going the wrong direction here, sorry. And there's a brief excerpt from the Bonn Declaration. We had a gathering of people from around the world in Bonn in April to try and do a sort of mid-decade accounting of where we are on the objectives of the UN decade. And the Bonn Declaration has been unanimously endorsed by UNESCO, will be sent to all countries to respond to, so there will again be another attempt to get governments engaged in this and through government, civil society, and business. And finally, I just want to close with something called the Aboriginal Thanksgiving Address, just to illustrate that some of the ideas around sustainability, which we can try and date as recent, are in fact ancient, or we should return to some of these ancient wisdoms. The idea that we must learn to walk softly on our sacred mother, the earth, and by the way, the earth the language that this comes from is Mother Earth. Mother means you who gave me life, and Mother Earth is you who makes all life possible. For we walk on the faces of the unborn, we must ensure that our actions do not prevent them from living a good life. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I always like the definition of an optimist as being somebody who gets out of the bath to answer the phone. We have a few minutes. Does anybody have any questions? No? Okay, well, we'll take a break then for some coffee, and we'll come back in 15 minutes, okay? Thanks.